Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of a bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack, for which it's a very familiar looking room today. First of all, hello, Chris.
Hello, you're right.
Yeah, look at you grinning away. You're basically hanging around like a bad smell because you've got a whiff of Princess Victoria Louise's perfume, haven't you?
I've heard the magic word.
You can sniff out a German-themed podcast at 30 paces, can't you?
Someone said something about German Navy and I didn't even ask what it was. I just turned up.
Standard. Right. Okay. And our guest today, let's be really official. Our guest today is Andrew Locke. Andrew is a PhD from the University of Suffolk, almost. He's also a trustee of the Great War Group, which I may have founded, but that's not the point. Locke, how did this talk come about? Use this to sell what you work at the Great War Group.
Well, firstly, let me just say it's an absolute pleasure to be on the podcast today again. We've been doing some recording today. So it's nice to be here in a kind of content creating capacity sort of. And this talk is a sort of version of one that I gave to the Great War Group membership who signed up to our course on waging war. And so we've been rocking and rolling through the major combatant countries in the First World War, talking about just what it was, not so much the military side of things and the kind of operations and the battles and stuff like that. We do a little bit of that, but actually it's more about kind of societal pressures, things at home and what it was like for people at home and the countries themselves and the dynamic of waging war, not necessarily the tactical side of things. So actually it's a bit of a step away from my research, which is tactical and pure military, and this rocks into society as well, which is really important.
It is really important. So we've done it so basically the membership can sign up for these courses, can't they? And this is an 8-week course, and we did 8 different countries, or we've done 6 now. I did Britain the other day and we have Italy and America yet to come, but Nikolai has done lectures on Austria-Hungary and Russia, you did Germany, Jim did France, unsurprisingly. So we are actually going to talk about how Germany as a nation waged war in World War One, aren't we? But I think we need to go all the way back to 1870 first, don't we, to explain why Germany is the way it is, how it thinks and how it ends up in this mess in the first place.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's a successful country, really, but it's one with a very deep and proud military tradition. And also quite a weird leadership, in the sense that on a certain level, they're democratic, sure, in the sense that after German unification comes out of, it does come out of conflict, conflicts that Prussia fights alongside its German allies against Denmark and Austria, Austria. And then it becomes the Austro-Hungarian Empire, really. And then France as well. And France is the big one in bringing these German states together into one single massive Central European power that Germany becomes, founded kind of around Prussia with most of the top leadership Prussia. Well, in fact, to be honest, when it comes to the top leadership, we end up with an emperor of Germany and then individual kings still in the German states. I mean, Bavaria had its own monarchy until 1918 as well, but this figurehead, this German emperor at the top, and then below that, kind of taking care of the day-to-day running of Germany. You did have elected officials, and on a certain level, it's more democratic than Britain, for example, in the sense that there's more people in Germany, or a higher percentage of the population of Germany can vote rather than Britain, because at least all men could vote, which we didn't have in Britain. I think it was 1871, we're still talking about maybe like 60% of men could vote, and no women. And no women could vote in Germany at that time either, but a higher proportion of their people could vote. Thing is, what we had in Britain was a head of state who was answerable to Parliament. You know, we've hammered that out in the 17th century, really, and over many centuries. Whereas with Germany, you had a head of state, and by the time of the First World War, obviously, it's Kaiser Wilhelm II, and he was not answerable to Parliament. So on the other hand, it's kind of democratic, elected officials taking care of the day-to-day running of the country, but with Henry VIII at the top, kind of untouchable there. So and he alone had war-making power. So when it comes to a decision for war, he's going to listen to his advisors, and really not necessarily anyone else if he doesn't want to. And his advisors are pretty uniformly men in their 50s and 60s from a background of usually the military in some capacity or other, with often having served as an officer in the Prussian army and been involved in the kind of military academy, and then gone on to take on, you know, maybe significant civilian roles, but also pretty commonly seen in uniform. So Chancellor in 1914 is a man called Thibault von Bettmann-Hollweg. You know, see him in his military uniform, if you like. The Minister of War at the time was Erich von Falkenhayn, and he goes on to be Chief of Staff in the German Army through the war. So you got this crossover, and it's a weird incestuous echo chamber of military men in civilian roles that would advise the Kaiser on war.
I mean, not to denigrate Chris's future father-in-law, but he is he is a bit of an issue, isn't he, Wilhelm? We've had a good laugh at his expense when Katja Hoyer was on. He's got some issues. His parent, well, his mother is quite a lot to blame for those issues. But he is an unfocused and not necessarily bright character. But he's good at PR, isn't he, before the First World War?
In the sense that he's very popular. I mean,
because he's had to, like, because there's no precedent. It's not like we have precedent for pretty much everything. But they had no precedent. They had to look back to the medieval time for German royalty precedent, didn't they?
His fate is very much tied to the success of the country, and the country is extremely successful. So why would he not be held in extreme prestige? You know, especially if he's tied to the fate of the army as well, and the army is extremely successful. So yes, the Kaiser is untouchable, not just from a kind of constitutional point of view, but also from a popularity and a loyalty point of view. They've got good reason to put their faith in him and in the army and in those big Prussian institutions, which are now German institutions as well. Why would they not?
Okay, so Germany ends up in a war. I think it's fair to say that we grew up being told that big bad Germany was all to blame because of a blank check. When actually people like Austria-Hungary and Serbia, especially Hungary, actually seem to have got off quite scot-free in the blame stakes over the last 100 years.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's that thesis that has gone around, hasn't it? The sleepwalkers thesis, which is we all just sort of bimble carelessly into war. I contest that actually you don't move several batteries of artillery to within range of Belgrade and then open fire on it by accident or by sleepwalking. No. Someone's got to give some orders there.
Austria wanted a war. They thought they were getting a localized war, but they wanted a war.
Yeah, and I think they had problems, and they didn't have the wit to come up with anything other than a big war. Maybe just a little war, maybe a little war, and maybe the Russians won't get involved. But if they do, then hey, our big friend Germany, with probably the strongest army in the world. No, I'm going to say strongest army in the world, Germany had in backs,
and Hungary very much to blame for this, because Hungary doesn't want to. Well, to improve matters in Austria-Hungary, you would have had to give better representation to more people. And Hungary are massively in opposition for this, because at the moment, it's only them and Austria. You make it a tri-monarchy with Slavs having their say as well, and Hungary misses out. So they are blocking a lot of what Austria might have considered prior to the First World War.
Hungary have quite a lot more clout than people think, and that's largely due to the fact that they kind of controlled the food. Germany actually couldn't, is in the same position as Britain prior to the war, and Austria. They couldn't feed themselves. And so Hungary quite rightly thought that they should have a significant amount of say within the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But then you're right. I mean, how many languages have you got in the Austro-Hungarian Empire? 19, is it? But that when you had the Wars of Unification that bring Germany together, Bismarck could potentially have said, yeah, let's bring Austria-Hungary into this and create this gigantic Central European superpower with a German language at its core. But I think Bismarck went, no, do you know what? I don't fancy that, actually, and all that nonsense away to our south. So let's focus on just Germany itself and leave the Austro-Hungarians to do their thing. When they stay friendly, I mean, what kind of brings them together, I guess, is the fear of encirclement that that Germany really had.
Bismarck was also quite... he didn't like the Austrians because they were considered to be massive rivals to Prussia. And they thought if we get Austria involved in Germany, then they're going to start trying to take power away from us. And we're Prussia's in charge. We don't want them to mess up our nice idea.
I think the blank check does exist, though, doesn't it, Lockie? And Germany is, in part, just as all the countries are, culpable for the beginning of the First World War.
Yeah, again, they had problems and they couldn't think of anything better than a war to solve them. What had happened, they'd let their, you know, initially Bismarck engineers alliances with the Austro-Hungarians and with Russia. But when Bismarck gets the boot and Wilhelm II takes over, he really lets that Russian relationship sour. Russia having their backsides handed to them by the Japanese in their little war spurs the Russians into military reform. French, very worried about a strong Germany, they go through military reforms as well, and they're kicking on hard while the Germans are having their naval arms race with Britain in the early 20th century. Now, when it comes to the naval arms race, Britain does comprehensively outspend Germany. I mean, this is the Navy. This is not something that Britain can really afford to lose out on. But also with France and Russia going through their military reforms, Germany then has to put the emphasis on army spending as well. And this is when there's fighting going on down in the Balkans as well. So things are cooking. If Germany's sort of feeling like war could break out across Europe, if it does, it's surrounded by the French and the Russians in this cast iron alliance. If it does, is it better to have a war sooner while Germany has the strongest army in the world? Or is it better to wait and let the French and the Russians go through their army reforms and then try and fight them? And really, there's only one answer to that for them. So they're firm in the belief that they're not touchable in an army sense. You know, they can win a war. But even so, I think there's belief in the German Reichstag in particular, and the Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg thinks that he can possibly achieve a lot of Germany's aims without going to war, maybe threaten war, mobilise, bring your strength together, and then get the British to negotiate and mediate between the powers. And actually, you can solve a lot of your problems without the need to actually go to war. You can have climb downs, you can have reassessments and look at the balance of power. Trouble is, the Austrians start shooting. And so any chance of climb down really stops because Russia feels like it has to mobilize. And as soon as Russia mobilizes, really, that takes the decision away from Germany.
Okay, I'm going to flip things around about now. We'll come back to land warfare, but longer in the making, I think, and more, it's definitely very personal to the Kaiser. Christopher, talk to us about the naval arms race and Germany and that.
Traditionally, Germany's not really been a sea power before before it, well, before 1871. You've got a few ships kicking around. They got beaten by the Danish fleet, warships during the second Schleswig War. And although they did all right during the Franco-Prussian War, they became, I think it all boiled down to the Kaiser. He just didn't like Edward the Seventh, and Edward the Seventh took them on the tour. You remember seeing all these British warships and passenger liners, and he turned around to his staff, said, "Right, we need a navy, and we need to do it now." And so you get Alfred von Tirpitz, who later becomes an admiral, who then tries to push through massive spending reforms to pay for a larger navy. And as Germany gets more and more of an empire, they need, I say empire, that sausage factory outside Lake Tanganyika, but they need a naval police force to react to any problems. And so the spending goes up. Unfortunately, the British have got the 1889 Naval Defence Act.
Just to explain that to people, the two power standard from 1889 means that Britain pledges to itself that the strength of the Royal Navy will always be equal to the strength of the next two biggest navies put together on the planet.
Which is, I saw a discussion the other day about had Russia gone to war with Britain in 1905 after the Dogger Bank incident, that the Russian squadron would have been completely decimated before it got to the Mediterranean, just with the reserves of British warships. They wouldn't have had to break out the majority of the fleet because they outnumbered them that much. Then you get HMS Dreadnought come along in 1905, Jackie Fisher's love child to the Navy, which makes all previous battleships obsolete. And Germany suddenly go, Germany, France, Russia, Austria all go, crap, we need one of those. But they can't build them at the same pace as Britain can build them. So by 1914, the German Navy is it's the second most powerful, second most modern in the world. But it's still not the same size as the Royal Navy. And it's just
they've accepted defeat as well, haven't they? They've stopped racing by that point.
Yeah. They realise that they can't. They just can't outpace British ship construction. And so they've come up
with... It's really big of you to admit that, Chris. We're really proud of you. I feel like this is like the 12 steps for a German naval addict, and you've just achieved step number one. We just need to get you to step 12, which is admitting that Jutland was a draw and that Germany didn't win.
I asked Ollie the other day, he's like, who won the Battle of Jutland? He went, Britain. I said, who do you think Daddy would say? He went, Germany. I went, no, it's a score draw, but I like what you're thinking.
Lockie, take us back to land, because you've already mentioned the German army. I don't think it's really in dispute, is it? It is the most formidable army on the planet at the time.
Yeah, in terms of sheer numbers, I mean, they can mobilise about 4 million men at the drop of a hat.
They're kind of worried that by 1916, Russia will be better off. But there's always the issue of supply with Russia and transport, isn't there?
Yeah, it's a fear that I think maybe has only really come into fruition in sort of 1943 to 45, this idea of a Russian steamroller. This podcast isn't about Russia really, but it doesn't quite happen as perhaps Germany feared in the First World War. And actually, their planning for war on two fronts was not to have a war on two fronts really. It was to have a quick war on one front, hold the Russians back with as little force as they can spare, really. But that little force that they spare, they have one army there, which ends up smashing two Russian armies in 1914. And that propels their army commander, Paul von Hindenburg, into the limelight. And he's a name to, well, hold on to, but also he's a guy with a lot to answer for as well for what happens later. Anyway. Off in the West, things don't go so well. You have the failure of the Schlieffen plan to encircle, break through, get round to Paris, knock the French out of the war, knock the puny Belgians and pathetic little British army forces aside. They don't quite manage any of that, really. And the French rally very impressively indeed, but they can mobilise a lot of men too. So it was a big optimistic swing at the French through Belgium. It didn't quite happen. And the German chief of staff resigned with his nerves in tatters. That's Moltke. He was off. So von Falkenhayn takes over as the head of the German army, and he stays in post until August 1916. So a lot of the big stuff, the big offensive of 1916 kick off with von Falkenhayn in charge. And they don't necessarily go quite the way he expects either. 1915, broadly speaking, Germany does okay in the war. Lots of inconclusive stuff, and there's some pretty miserable things, and they have some PR disasters as well. Because 1915 is a miserable year for propaganda for Germany. They kick off with using poison gas first, which the British jump up and down and say, oh, look at these terrible barbaric people and this wretched weapon of war that they're using to inflict a cruel and unusual death on men all over the place. And while the British are jumping up and down all over the place and saying those things, they're also stockpiling lots of poison gas. May, you have the sinking of the Lusitania as well, which the Americans are very upset about, because there's American civilians on board and quite a lot of munitions as well, but it's still a PR fail for the Germans. And then towards the end of the year, in October, they shoot a British nurse as well, Edith Cavell, who'd been smuggling soldiers and military age out, military age men out to neutral countries and getting them away from German captivity, and the Germans caught her and shot her. But from that point on, the British are able to say, look at these terrible people again, executing nurses because they fancy it. So 1915 on a certain level goes all right for the Germans, but they don't make any friends around the world. 1916, yeah, it's the big offensives. So it kicks off with the German offensive at Verdun, and then the British join in a bit later on the Somme, and the Russians join in too at Brusilov. Offensive, and that's when things start turning for Germany, really.
Okay, so that's a brief look at the military side of things, but that's not what we're primarily here to do today. So let's talk about German society during the First World War. You've got it in two distinct phases. The first one is August 14 to August 16.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, I mean, that's when things are mostly going okay. Actually, the Germans have set up an economic model for themselves, which is mainly based on a short war. Which is public subscriptions to buy in to the German war effort with war bonds, effectively. And they do these in every 6 months or so. So they start off in September 1914, and then they do another one in spring 1915 and spend autumn 1915 and then spring 1916 again. And these are actually quite effective in keeping down the German short-term debt. These are working, and the German war economy is working until August 1916, effectively. Now, there's a few things that go wrong in the second half of 1916. The first thing is performance on the battlefield starts to wobble a little bit. Falkenhayn gets sacked as chief of staff of the German army, and Paul von Hindenburg, who beat the Russians over in 1914, he gets put in charge. Now, with him comes Erich Ludendorff, his quartermaster general. And between Hindenburg and Ludendorff, they essentially run the country, not quite, for a year or so, they're just in charge of the army. A year later, things change domestically. But what they insist on straight away is a massive re-gearing of the German war economy. Okay, essentially, what's happened is, with the Somme offensive kicking on, the British have started to pull their weight in like July and August 1916. Prior to that, they weren't really. So we need more munitions, more men in uniform, and everything else, everything ramped up and pure gearing for war at home. That's what they insist on. Now, there's some problems with this. Firstly, they're going to need to spend a lot more money. The system of public subscriptions works to a point, but can't just produce money out of thin air. From that point on, the debt starts increasing. Now, that's okay as long as they think they're going to get a big payday. at the end of it. So as long as the Germans think they're going to win, they can just keep that debt number growing. Problems later there. What we also have is a re-gearing of things like the German chemical industry back at home. Now, Germany had quite a strong chemical industry, but they need it all to produce munitions. Now, without getting into too much detail on chemistry, fertilizer and explosives have quite similar chemical makeups. And so if you're going to produce more explosives, you ain't going to produce much more fertilizer. Imports, they were reliant on imports of things like saltpeter from South America to help make explosives. They're not coming in anymore because of the blockade, which has been going since, well, August 1914, really. So imports are stuffed. Production of fertilizer is stuffed. Horses get dragged off into the army. So agriculture is going to suffer. Men get dragged into the army as well. And so food output goes through the floor. Also, autumn 1916, it's very wet and the potato harvest rots in the ground. And so from autumn 1916, the country's economy is on the slide. Food production drops off a cliff. People are going to be hungry. That is where it starts to unravel a little bit for Germany. That's not them done, though. Very far from it. A lot of fighting potential still to come. And that gearing to produce more munitions, well, it did. So there's a lot more fighting still to do.
By this point, it's clear that Germany probably aren't going to win. So how badly does it go for them?
Well, you say that clear they're not going to win. Actually, I mean, 1917 is a really interesting year. I mean, after they gear things up for war production at home, I mean, it works to a point. They do produce a lot more stuff, lots more of this sort of smaller variety of machine guns, loads of artillery as well. And they also change the focus. So where they'd attacked the French in 1916, from 1917, it's really going to be the Russians that they go for. And it works. So 1917 starts pretty scarily for Germany, because you have the big offensives in the West, and the French offensive doesn't go very well. As we know, the Nivelle offensive does fail, but the British look to be very, very strong. And the Russians go through their February Revolution, but the provisional government that comes in seems to think they're going to continue the war. So in mid-1917, oh, and the Americans join it, of course, as well, in April 1917. So in middle of 1917, that's when the Germans are probably a little bit worried, and that's when you have the big discussions in the Reichstag to discuss the possibility of peace. Now, the main kind of result from that is the chancellor who allowed the debate on the peace resolution is our man Bethmann-Hollweg, who'd been in there from the start. Hindenburg and Ludendorff go to the Kaiser and say, this guy clearly isn't patriotic enough. He's allowing us to talk of surrender without annexations. We need him gone. Kaiser says, yes, okay, we'll stick someone else in then. And they end up going with a total nobody called Georg Michaelis, who just relies on his army support for all of his power. He's an army sock puppet. It doesn't last too much longer, but he's there for now. And it's basically a military dictatorship is essentially what we have. So that's 1917 kind of from a political point of view. What happens thereafter on the battlefields? The Western Allies offensive stall in Flanders. This is Third Ypres campaign, and even Cambrai later doesn't achieve what they wanted to. So you have the British army tangled in barbed wire and Flanders mud at the same time as the Germans are smashing the Russians again. So they force their way into the Baltic countries and capture Riga and smuggle Lenin back into Russia as well. And then you have the Bolshevik Revolution. So you have the Russians actually dropping out of the war. Now, it doesn't go quite as easily as the Germans hope in terms of bringing soldiers over to the West, but they can bring a lot. So having gone from a very low ebb in morale sense in the middle of 1917, and the fear that they're not going to win, or is going to really struggle to win, we get into early 1918, and what's happened is the Russians have surrendered. The Italians have been smashed at Caporetto by this time. The British army's knackered because of its efforts in Flanders and elsewhere. The French army still isn't up to the grade that it was earlier in the conflict in terms of manpower. And then Americans, they haven't come up to strength yet, and they're still making the same mistakes that the British army was making in 1915. So when we talk about kind of it being clear that the Germans weren't going to win. Actually, you take a poll in Germany in early 1918, they're absolutely convinced, there's no doubt in their mind, that victory is just around the corner. And when the big offensives start in 1918, it seems clearer than ever that Germany is going to win because they have great success early on. Now, this is a bit of a fig leaf for some big problems. There are loads of strikes at home, but people are really not happy. They're extremely hungry. The excess death rate in Germany is extremely high as well. And when we get later into 1918, it's really no exaggeration to say that hunger and conditions and disease exacerbated by hunger and conditions are killing almost as many people as on the battlefield. But while they think the payday is coming, they can put up with a lot, actually, the German people. And it's going back to, you know, what we said at the start here. They had a lot of faith in their leadership, in their Kaiser and their army as well. It's never let them down before. It doesn't seem to be letting them down now. And victory is just around the corner and it will all be worth it. This war is such a one for the investment growing as conditions get worse, because the idea of surrender after all of this, or defeat after all of this, is just unthinkable. Okay, people have to keep fighting to the end. And that's the attitude in Germany. So when the German spring offensives fail eventually, they start getting tired in April and May, and by July, the French counterattack stops the last German offensives dead in their tracks. And then in August, you have the big British-led attacks at Amiens, which then kick on to that full front action commanded by Marshal Foch. Germany by that point is on struggle street. The big breakthrough is the Hindenburg line going at the end of September 1918, and that's when the army leadership sends the word back to Berlin saying, yeah, we can't win this anymore. And you try and put yourself in the mind of some of these German people and the German leadership, and they've been feeding the people in Germany this diet of, gonna win, we're gonna win. And earlier in the year, it's like, we're going to win this year. This is our moment. This is Germany reaching the pinnacle of its power, and we are unstoppable, and we are going to be put in that position of greatness that we've suffered so long for. And then the word comes back saying, yeah, no, not happening. Sorry, what? And people are understandably very upset. So our new chancellor at that time, Georg von Hertling, he resigns. There's a real flap in early October to try and get a new chancellor in. Nobody wants the job. Who wants to be on the bridge of the ship that's sinking? It ends up being Prince Max von Baden who takes over, in close cooperation with the Social Democrats, of the Reichstag, because they're the largest party. And ultimately, if, you know, they're going to try and form a government, they're going to be needed. And as things worsen through October and calls for an end to the war, immediate peace, and if not revolution looks plausible, it becomes clear they're going to have to take some pretty drastic methods to restore order, to avoid something like the Russian Revolution of the previous year. And that,
this is the thing, isn't it? Like, you're looking east, and the people across Europe are genuinely afraid. It's in Britain as well, because there's strikes all over Britain in 1917 as well. That this is a plague that is catching communism.
Yeah, it is, and with it, it's not a happy go lucky form of revolution either. I mean, this thing in Russia when it kicked on was brutal and murderous. And so anyone of any kind of, you know, standing is thinking, oh God, if these people got the power, I'm going to get shot dead or chucked down a well or have my brains bashed in or something like that. And it really is that visceral of fear that people had. All these politicians thinking, well, our country's going to fall apart. We're going to be dismembered unless we can hold things together back here. And so while the army is fighting, you have characters like Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg leading protests and huge gatherings actually in Berlin itself. Berlin becomes so dangerous that the Kaiser has to leave and not run away completely just yet. He just leaves Berlin for the time being and goes out into the countryside. The armies carry on fighting, and actually kind of on the Western Front, the casualties among the Allied countries that are trying to defeat the German armies are still very high. But what Germany, because the German armies are still fighting, they've got no shortage of munitions either. They've got tons of artillery and millions of machine gun bullets. They're running short of men to fire them, but that idea of fighting on to the end is still there. But what Germany can't do at this time, because it doesn't have the economic strength anymore to back it up, or the industrial capacity to back it up, is send aid to the other countries that it was helping before. So that's the Ottoman Empire, that's Bulgaria, that's Austria-Hungary as well. And so around about the same time as the Hindenburg Line breaks, Allied offences down in Macedonia break through the Bulgarian army as well. They're not receiving support from the Germans anymore, and so the Bulgarians stick their hands in the air. With that, the Ottoman Empire, with its northern flank now up in the air, says, hey, do you know what, we're done as well. And then the Austro-Hungarians, who had been trying to negotiate peace for some time by this stage, actually separately, the new Emperor Karl really wasn't that interested in carrying on an horrible war. He now realizes he's going to have Marshal Franche d'Esprit at the head of a Franco, Anglo, Greek, Serbian, all sorts army marching on Vienna, within, and then meeting the Italians there potentially as well. So the Austro-Hungarians jack it. And all of this would be bad enough if the Germans only had their own enemies to fight. What you have is discussions in Berlin as the Western armies are being marched back. The Eastern allies are folding. You've got conversations going on between the army leadership and the political leadership saying, can you keep fighting? You know, we're going to get some pretty harsh terms from the Western allies. Unless we can kill a few more hundred thousand of them, then they might soften their terms up a little bit. And then we have the Kiel Mutiny. So on top of armies approaching from the south and southeast, their Western army being mauled by the British and French and Americans and even Belgians by this stage. They also have their own sailors jumping off ships with rifles and moving through cities like Hamburg and Kiel and Bremen. And socialist revolution fermenting in Berlin. So it really becomes a stage.
Tell us what it looks like to a German on the ground. It must be terrifying.
Well, yeah, complete chaos. I mean, when we, by the time we get into early November, it is absolutely clear that the end is imminent. It's just a case of how Germany survives as a country after the inevitable defeat comes. Are we going to get some decent terms from the Americans? While they might hope for some decent terms from the Americans, are the French going to listen to them? Probably not.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Because Woodrow Wilson has already made it very clear he's got this idea for a League of Nations. He's not really interested in vengeance and stuff. But tell that to the French.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really not clear what they're going to get from them. And when it gets to the 9th of November, 9th of November is, of course, Day of Destiny in Germany anyway. There's so many big things that happen on the 9th of November historically, from, you know, the Berlin Wall opening in 1989. This is a big one because essentially we have the armistice delegation away in France trying to get the French to stop killing their soldiers so that they can bring them back and fight the revolution in Germany itself. And so they're asking for peace terms. You know, an armistice is absolutely necessary for Germany at this time. You have sailors moving through German cities, as we've said, but the crowds in Berlin start gathering. And it's just, you've got nothing else to do, really. You know, defeat is imminent. You want to know what's going on. So huge crowds forming outside the Reichstag building, the parliament building, huge crowds following Karl Liebknecht around and going to the Royal Palace. And word reaches the Reichstag that Karl Liebknecht is about to proclaim a socialist republic in Berlin down at the Royal Palace. And one of the Reichstag deputies, a social democrat, Philipp Scheidemann, decides to preempt him by climbing out the window. One of the second story windows of the Reichstag building, climbs out and to the crowd there he proclaims a republic there on the spot. And his leader, Friedrich Ebert, is inside trying to negotiate or trying to work out what it is they're going to do, you know, what post-war Germany is going to look like and what can we sell to the Allies to make it look like we are serious about peace. you know, obviously the Kaiser's not going to be able to stay in post, but maybe we'll stay as a constitutional monarchy somehow. And someone comes running in and goes, what's that cheering going on? Friedrich, you might want to come and have a chat with Bill. He's just proclaimed a republic outside. So it's absolute chaos in Berlin. It's madness. But huge crowds expectant of some kind of redemption maybe for them, or at least hoping for the aversion of disaster, you know, having suffered for so long. So it's incredibly serious and incredibly heavy stuff.
No chance for Kaiser in Victoria Louise then.
What does happen to her, Chris? Fill us in. Everyone wants to know what happens to your future wife.
She marries in 1913 to another German prince. I don't remember his name. He's not important. And she lives out her life on her estates quite happily. Still trying to get back some of her belongings, but never gets it back, and just happily lives out her life until 1980.
Waiting for the day you sweep her off her feet, right?
She died a month after I was born.
Yeah, poor Chris.
Yeah, next time.
Like two ships passing in the night, right?
Yeah, we need to hurry up and invent that time machine. Yeah. You can be that unnamed German noble and live a happy pastoral life.
You know his light. You know his luck. He'll end up at the bottom of a mine shaft. It won't even kill him either. He'll just be whimpering down there with a twisted ankle.
Or wake up on a gunboat somewhere out in his Tsingtao and be part of the East Asian squadron. So, that's going to end well.
Oh, God. Yeah, I know how this goes.
Someone let me off the ship.
Lockie, summarise Germany's war for us. Your summary, you put, like, how to screw up a successful country in 4 years and 3 months.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, they could potentially, if they'd swallowed their pride, have maybe arranged peace in early 1917, possibly, I think. You know, if they'd agreed to obviously hand back all of France and Belgium that they'd taken. I doubt the Western Allies would care very much if they made some territorial gains in the East. Possibly they would have done. I doubt they would have lost too much sleep, really. Maybe a referendum in Alsace and Lorraine about rejoining France, something like that. Swallow their pride, suck it up, and maybe they have had a chance for peace and keep their country together. But they decided not to. They decided to press on to whatever end, and the end that they got was complete and utter ruination, and creating the kind of conditions in which real nastiness can take hold. And if anything, I kind of resent the German leadership for doing this. I also think the Western Allies rather forgot their Machiavelli, in the sense that when you've got a defeated enemy there, you either treat them with kindness so they don't want to have a go at you, or you utterly wipe them out so they can't have a go at you. And they did neither. So, yeah, poor decisions all round, really. I mean, the German soldier could fight. In the First World War, it's a little bit different to the Second World War in terms of the motivation for fight and the ideology they were fighting for. I don't think it's particularly sinister necessarily in the First World War. It's God, King and Fatherland for the ordinary German soldier, same as for most of the other countries. But I think the leadership themselves could have done with giving themselves a bit of a shake and trying to lose some of that pride, which they never did. And there was consequences for all of them.
Yep, thus sowing the seeds for World War II and everything that was to follow. Lockie, thank you so much. This has been brilliant. This has been a crash course in how Germany waged World War I unsuccessfully. If you were interested in learning more stuff like this, then do join the Great War Group, and then you will be getting magazines and courses and conferences and just bludgeoned with the knowledge from all directions. And there's quite a few opportunities for drinking as well. And Chris will be there wearing his German Admiral's hat.
And teaching everyone why I hate England, apparently.
Yeah.
He will be wearing other stuff, not just his Admiral's hat.
Especially after the last conference.
Yeah. Excellent. Thanks very much, Lockie.
Cheers. Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, We have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.